Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. My name's Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
It looks like a kitchen in here. We've got cups strewn about. There's donuts. Mm-hmm. We've got restaurant stuff over there. It smells like a bakery in here. I think I'm in the wrong room.
It's the brunch buffet edition of True Crime on Easy Street.
Is that what it is?
Every now and then we need to eat, Scott.
Yeah.
I had a waffle this morning.
Not from our buffet, though.
We not from have. This buffet.
Yeah, but you
across
had a waffle.
The street.
Do you do the fruit waffle, chocolate chip, plain?
No, they tried to peddle some strawberries on me. I said,
pecan,
no thanks.
Plain.
Just plain with a little syrup.
Oh, I like the strawberries with the whipped cream.
Mm.
Yeah, I told them to leave that off.
No, none of that. What kind of syrup?
Huddle House brand.
Just regular.
Whatever that is.
Syrup.
Yeah, just,
Do you like it warm?
No, just room temperature's fine.
All right, we just
I didn't have that option.
I just wanted everybody to learn a little something about Scott today.
I'm there a lot, but I don't think I have been there enough yet that they will let me go back into the kitchen and use the microwave. But I haven't asked. I'm not sure.
Shane and I had brunch the other day at this place in Chattanooga, and he got chicken and waffles, and that was the best waffle I've had in...
What was the name of that place?
It's called the Whitebird. It's in the Edwin Hotel over there. It's right in front of the walking bridge.
It's been a long time since I've been to Chattanooga, but I always love Chattanooga.
It's a great city.
The downtown area, is that where you guys were, Katie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we were on the end of the downtown area, so we were right on the water. Like our hotel was on Aquarium Way,
it's right
in front of the walking bridge. Right.
Fun. And so, Scott, you've always described center ABC, an ABC triangle.
That's right.
With Chattanooga being the C part.
Atlanta, Birmingham, Chattanooga. We're right in the middle. An hour and a half from every one of those three places.
What a great place to live.
Yay,
right?
Cherokee County. The Chamber thinks so, and they're one of our sponsors.
I love that. I agree with the Chamber.
My advice, if you're going to Chattanooga, is if you're looking at that triangle, you want to go that straight route.
Yes.
Up the interstate.
Yes.
Yeah, 59.
It don't. That road is horrendous.
Yeah, they're always working on it.
Is there construction currently? Because there always seems to be.
The construction's not even the worst part. It's the car-sized potholes and the lips on the road that you don't even notice really until you're...
At 80 miles an hour.
Until you hit one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would recommend going
the scenic route?
Yeah, going through Somerville and hitting that. I don't know, the road one, I think, is it? Is that Highway 1?
How about that?
That's one of them.
That's a great drive.
That's how we came home because we were like, we cannot go. Shane's going to bust a tire.
Well, right. And pouring into Chattanooga from the interstate, it just bottlenecks.
Yeah,
it's really
right there
difficult.
What is that?
I don't know what that is.
What's the bend in the river called?
I don't know.
But it is. It's where the road just, and it's like, add another lane.
Yeah.
Or close one of these lanes off for just the entrance.
Because they could do that. There's not a whole lot they can do with their roads in Tennessee because there's a lot of mountains. Mm-hmm. But that particular space, they could.
And at least for a ways.
Yeah.
Because there is, we were in standstill traffic right there. That was another one of my problems. For nothing.
Oh.
That's the worst kind.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
When it just opens up and you look around and you're like, nothing.
What happened here?
2 miles ahead of you, some idiot almost missed their off ramp. Slammed on the brakes in the middle of traffic, somehow managed not to get run over, and made their turn and got off where they wanted to.
But then slowed everybody else down.
Everybody behind him pays the price.
You're exactly right about that.
Some idiot, probably with a Georgia license plate. Not that people from Georgia...
Oh, no!
Not that none of them can drive, but the ones that I've ever been behind cannot.
Oh, no.
I'll tell you, I enjoyed my drive through Georgia home more than my drive through Tennessee.
So. All right. Yeah, I bet I bet the guy who missed his exit was from Georgia.
We're just bashing everybody today, aren't we?
Apologies to everyone from Georgia.
Right. He should have took the other way in.
Yeah.
No reason for him to be on that road.
Right. Scott is sorry, but not sorry.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, we get a lot of, it's weird to say, we get tourists.
We are a tourist community.
Here. And the lake. In the
mountains.
Mm-hmm. Lake life is pretty cool here.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we record, this is Labor Day weekend. Hope you all had a safe and relaxing Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
But this is usually the time of year when the tourists go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that we're mad about that.
We're not mad. We love the commerce and all of that. But
bring your wallet.
But it's going to be different after Labor Day.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. The town's
noticeably,
packed right now.
Noticeably fewer cars on the street at lunch hour.
Mm-hmm.
after this past weekend.
Yep, exactly. So here we are in September. I can't believe it's September already.
Why? Because it's still 90 degrees?
Yes.
That's one reason.
Yes.
It does not feel like September yet.
It doesn't.
I mean, football on the... I mean, everyone at those football games yesterday had to have been...
Oof.
Oh, yeah.
This is a hard time to go to football in the SEC.
And sit in the sun all day, especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still, I'm going to say, put that sunscreen on from now until the end of October, because you just, the way this weather is here, you never know. Last year, in a pickleball tournament in October.
You got sunburned?
Sunburned.
Oh, yeah?
Like crazy. Yes.
Well, you were out in it for hours.
Though. Hours.
With no sun.
But again, screen. I say it was October.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking. I should have been thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, so yeah. Keep that sunscreen going.
I'll bet your light-complected husband was wearing his sunscreen that day if he was there.
He showed up for a little bit and then went home. He didn't stay the whole time. But yeah, he wears his sunscreen a lot.
Yeah. He puts his on to go check the mailbox.
I wear sunscreen on my face every day. Now, the rest of me...
Yeah,
who knows,
but it's just part of your morning treatment in the bathroom.
Sunscreen on my face every morning.
I use lotion on my face every morning, but it's not a sunscreen. I should get that.
You need an SPF. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well. Too late for today.
Well, yeah. Do we have any shout outs?
I got one.
Go ahead.
So a couple of weeks ago, a guy named Manfred Onod, I think I'm pronouncing that right. He lives in Appledore, Devon, England.
Wow, yeah.
And he shouted out to us on Facebook, and he couldn't stop saying nice things about true crime on Easy Street. Aww. He really just, he found us by accident. He was looking for some information about a guy named Gary Mitchum Reeves from Rome, Georgia, which we have done a podcast episode about. That's earlier this season back in February.
Mm-hmm.
And he found, for some reason, he was looking that up. There's a story. I'm not going to get into it. Manfred knows what it is, and I do, and that's good enough.
Yeah.
So he's looking up Gary Mitchum Reeves, somehow finds our podcast, starts listening. He's a big fan of the show now. And I got on Google Maps and did the little street walk through Appledore.
Mm-hmm.
Cute little oceanside town.
Ooh.
Oh,
down
fun.
In the southwest corner of England. Mm-hmm. Very nice little place.
Could it be a sister city to Center?
Kind of, sort of. Yeah, fun. It's where a river empties into the sea.
Oh, okay.
And,
I bet it's beautiful.
And the city is right there where the bay is.
Appledore.
And it's not huge. It's kind of a small bay.
Mm-hmm.
You can see from one side to the other. You could probably swim. It's that close.
It sounds
But a
like...
very nice looking little town. And it's a touristy town. You can there are shops along the waterfront and a walking path like a boardwalk.
Yeah.
Cute little town.
Road trip.
We'll have to swim there. But anyway, Manfred Onod from England.
Thank you, Manfred.
Shout out to you, sir.
Shout out. That's really neat.
Mm-hmm,
and we've got some more shout outs, but we'll save some for later.
Okay.
Some new listeners that I found out just this past week.
Awesome.
But we'll talk about that. Not today.
Love when Scott just shuts it down. He's like, nah.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that today.
Oh, then you guys are going to hate
usually,
this episode.
It's usually the same time he goes, there's a lot of people in this story. I'm not going to give you any of their names.
Happening again today. Not really. Today's story is about two people in particular.
Okay.
There are other people who are involved.
We will know their names, though.
We will know those two.
Okay, that's fine.
And if you've read the title of the episode, you already know one of them.
Okay, I'll just take what I can get.
Yeah. So today, guys, are you ready to get started?
Yeah.
Are we ready to do this?
Let's do it.
So today we're going to squeeze into one episode the story of the assassination of the 20th president of the United States, James Garfield.
James Garfield.
We could do a lot more. We could do 3 or 4 episodes about this, but we're just going to squeeze it into one. Like we say here all the time, even though we are your team of experts.
Yeah.
We're the 101 version of true crime. So it's a very interesting story, but we're going to squeeze it all into one episode. We're going to maximize the excitement.
I can't wait.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice. I promise we're not going to leave you hanging.
Oh, good.
We're going to tell you every detail that you need to know. We're not going to half-ass this story.
Good.
We're going to whole-ass it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting, I promise.
Everybody
Kelly always gets a little unnerved when I tell her that I'm going to do a story that tiptoes around history before it gets to the crime. She's like, ugh, I'm always afraid that it's going to be terrible.
That's true. I did say that.
Yes.
Yeah, but then I followed up with.
I know you followed up and said, but you always learn something new. And I did too. I learned a lot of new stuff. I didn't know. I knew almost nothing about this story.
I know nothing about this story. And I apologize to my history teachers through the years. I'm sure
I don't know
we
if
covered it, but
this
I
is
don't
probably
remember.
Two paragraphs in a history book in 10th grade.
Hmm.
So you forgot all about it.
I'm sure I did. That would have been Mr. Ford, would have been my teacher.
Yeah.
Oh, Shout out to Mr. Doug Ford.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Doug.
Yeah.
Now, if you want the full story about this, about this story that we're going to tell you today, there is an app you can download on your television. It's called History Vault.
Okay.
I think it's like $5 a month. A lot of different documentaries about this story. And there's a book that was written in 2011 by an author named Candace Millard.
Wait. You're telling me you pay for a history app on your TV?
That's right.
You canceled Netflix the other day because you didn't want to pay for it anymore.
I know, but I got a coworker's password for Netflix.
Oh, you better not say that in the universe. They'll know.
Let's not publish that.
Never mind. Retract that. Through the magic of editing, Redacted. Katie can make that go away. The title of the book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. See, it's going to be interesting. I told you. Kelly's not saying anything because she's eating a donut.
Is this our last? Is this our last?
No. There's one more that is possible.
Who's left?
That would be McKinley. So we're going to hop over a bunch of rabbit holes today. But every one of them, should I wait for you to finish chewing?
Nope.
Every one of the rabbit holes I'm going to skip over today is told in vivid detail in Candace Millard's book. And the book does a really good job of telling both sides of the story, and I'm going to try to do the same thing today in the podcast. And by both sides, what I mean is the story is really about two men. You already know the name of one of them. It's James Garfield.
Yes. Yes.
The other person you're going to learn a lot today about today is the man who shot him.
Okay.
And we'll get to that in a minute. One of the more interesting aspects of this story, and really it's one of the reasons why this story happened, it's because of what happened at the 1880 Republican Convention in Chicago.
Okay.
When James A. Garfield, he was a Republican congressman at the time, in the summer of 1880, he walked into that convention that day in Chicago with absolutely no intention whatsoever of being a candidate for president.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, he was there to give a nominating speech for his fellow Ohioan, a man named John Sherman, who was then the Secretary of the Treasury.
All right.
And Sherman, along with Ulysses S. Grant, long story, we're not going into it, one of those two fully expected to be the Republican candidate for president.
All right. Yeah, because they typically go in with a pretty good
idea.
Yeah,
even back then. Yeah. Garfield was there to nominate Sherman. He was going to stand up on the stage and say, vote for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
That was his plan.
All right.
And the next thing James Garfield knew, everyone in that convention was committed to voting for him to be the nominee for president.
How did that happen?
Good question.
Okay.
Now, before we tell you exactly what happened at that convention, we have to tell you a little bit about James Garfield.
All right.
The man who would go on to become the 20th president of the United States. A very interesting story. He was known as General Garfield to most everybody for most of his adult life. And that was because of his service to the Union Army during the Civil War.
He was a general?
He eventually was, yes. Okay. He was just glad to be there at the convention in Chicago, like I said. He was born into abject poverty. He was the last of the log cabin presidents. He was born in a log cabin in Ohio, the name Mentor, Ohio, M-E-N-T-O-R.
So the last of one of the presidents who sort of understood what it meant to have to work hard for something and to be a commoner.
An everyday person who goes on to great success.
Yeah. I mean, I think people in present day try to present that, but it's
this was the real story. This was the real deal.
Yeah.
So by the time he was born into poverty, his father died when he was two. James Garfield didn't own a pair of shoes until he was 4 years old.
Wow.
By the time he was in his 30s, he had become a very successful politician. And it wasn't because he was an overambitious asshole or a conniving narcissist or a deceitful dirtbag. What I'm trying to say is James A. Garfield was not a typical politician.
Correct. Well,
just by the smidgen of that story you've started, you don't walk into a room and make a bunch of grown men vote for you and not be likable.
And, exactly. And not be and totally humble enough to not even see it coming.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So Garfield was a good man, as we all can agree, even based on what little we know about him.
Yeah.
Learning was his passion in life. He was destined to be an academic until outside forces intervened. It was his love of learning, in fact, that had freed him from his childhood poverty. From an early age, Garfield had understood that knowledge led to progress, and as Millard wrote in her book, progress was his country's only hope for escaping its own painful past. And by that, what I mean is that Garfield, by the time he was an adult and a politician, he was a staunch abolitionist. Okay. He wanted to free the slaves.
Okay.
In fact, at one point in his life, he had even harbored an escaped slave and helped them escape to the North.
Wow.
At the age of 11, when Garfield's older brother had stopped his schooling to help, to start helping on the farm, both James's mother and his older brother said, "You're not coming to the farm to work. You're going to go to school." And that turned out to be a great idea for the Garfield family because James Garfield was a rare mind. His first year of preparatory school, I guess what we would call a junior college, he worked off his tuition as a janitor because he could not afford the tuition. By his second year, he was an assistant professor. In addition to taking his own class load, he still worked as janitor. He worked as a professor and he taught six classes, including mathematics and ancient languages. In one of the documentaries I watched, it said that Garfield could write Latin with one hand and simultaneously write ancient Greek with the other.
He's a genius.
Yeah.
That's insane.
After he graduated, after he moved on from the preparatory school, he graduated from Williams College in Massachusetts in 1856. He came back to his earlier school, his preparatory school, as a full professor. By the age of 26, he was the president of the school.
Wow.
It's known as Hiram College in Ohio today. In 1859, though, two events happened that ended Garfield's promising academic career, and that was politics and the war.
Okay.
So a state senator from Ohio passed away unexpectedly in the summer of 1859, and the party reached out to Garfield and asked him if he would allow his name to be placed on the ballot. He said, "Sure, but I'm not going to campaign."
Was he already a member of the Republican Party?
I suppose that
he was at the time. Active or had to have been.
But if he was an abolitionist in the 1850s, then yeah, he was probably
a Republican.
Yeah, already.
Already. And then just all of these.
He probably voted Republican.
And all of these spectacular accomplishments fast.
Yeah. He was known.
People knew.
Hey, this guy's the college president. Let's put him on the put him on the ballot.
Yeah.
So Garfield wins overwhelmingly. He never in his life lost an election. And for better or worse, well, and worse, that ended him up on a path that led to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I'm going to say worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after Garfield got involved in politics, he became a state senator. That's when the Civil War began. And famously, at one point during the war, he was a lieutenant colonel when this happened, Katie. But he led an armed, he led an inferior army, like 1,000 troops, and they ran off like 5,000 Confederates from the state of Kentucky, which basically kept Kentucky from seceding from the Union and kept Kentucky in the Union. So he got a lot of credit for that battle. I forget what the name of the battle was. It doesn't matter. I think it's something Creek, like a lot of them are or were. But he eventually got promoted to general, and that's why for the rest of his life, most people who knew him.
Well, sure. That was his title.
General Garfield. Yeah. Even when he was president.
Yeah.
They called him General Garfield.
And what a way to get that title. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in 1862, right in the middle of the Civil War, Garfield got elected to U.S. Congress. While he's out fighting in the Civil War, somebody puts his name on the ballot. He gets elected to U.S. Congress. Overwhelmingly, again, because his reputation precedes him. And President Lincoln convinced Garfield to quit the army and come take his seat in Congress because Lincoln wanted as many abolitionist allies as he could get because he's trying to free the slaves.
Yes, that was his number one priority.
Yes. So Garfield spent the next 17 years as a rarity in Washington, D.C., an honest, decent, trustworthy, relatively humble man who saw what naked, brazen political ambition had done to so many of his colleagues who wanted to be president no matter the cost. Garfield wanted no part of that.
He was too smart for that.
And so, of course, he ended up being the presidential nominee in 1880 in Chicago.
I wish that happened today.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't it?
All right, so now we have to go over the parts of the convention story that have something to do with why Garfield ends up getting shot the next summer. So we're back at the Republican convention. It's Chicago. It's 1880. 1880, think about it. That's 4 years after Custer's last stand.
Yeah, that's right.
Telephone was still such a novelty that only the rich and a few big cities even had phones installed anywhere yet. That had only been, that was also 1876 when Alexander Graham Bell, who we'll mention again later, invented the telephone. Billy the Kid was still on the run from the law in the summer of 1880.
Good grief.
That's the kind of time frame we're talking about. Still 4 years away from the fountain pen being invented. So if you wanted to write something back in 1880, you dipped a pen in ink and you wrote.
It probably had a feather.
One sentence at a time. Yeah.
And why did, when you see clips from that, why does everybody have such wonderful handwriting? I don't know that that's the truth, but.
Well, that was the only way to communicate. So you did a lot more writing with your hand.
It seemed very formal, I guess. And just beautiful handwriting.
Yeah, I know. I saw some of the letters that the people that are involved in the story wrote back in the day.
Yeah.
Beautiful handwriting. Yeah. So in the decades that followed the Civil War, which ended in 1865, the Republican Party had split into two main factions. You were either what was called a stalwart or you were what was called a half-breed, which is a little derisive, but that was the term for somebody who, if you were a stalwart, you were, number one, you were opposed to reconciliation with the South.
You were opposed to
opposed.
It. Okay.
And you viciously defended what was called the spoils system. And I'll explain that.
Oh, but, no, I know what you, okay. I know exactly what
it's
you're
It's government
about.
Patronage.
Every
time an administration changed, the incoming administration cleaned house and hired people that were loyal to them to run the government.
Oh, okay. Yeah, to the victor goes the spoils.
Exactly.
That's what I was
that
thinking.
Was the
yeah,
way, yeah the, that was the way victor. It worked in 1880 in this country. In fact, the previous administration was Rutherford B. Hayes. He was a Republican as well. He was not running for re-election because he'd become so fed up with the spoils system that he just said to the GOP, screw it, I'm going home to Ohio. Nominate somebody else. Okay. I don't want to do this anymore.
I mean, I can respect that.
Yeah. And if you weren't a stalwart, you were somebody like James A. Garfield, and you were, the stalwarts considered it a derisive term to call you a half-breed. That meant that you were a Republican in name only. It's a rhino is what it's called today.
They're trying to say that you really
you're
aren't.
Not fully committed to Republicanism, so you're just a half-breed.
Okay. And these are the individuals who wanted to bring the country
they
back
wanna,
together.
Yeah, they want to get the country back together. They want to get the South re-involved in running the government. And they want to get rid of the spoils system. They want to change it. They want to make it, it's what eventually happened, and we'll explain how that did happen, but they want it to be based on merit.
Yeah.
You take a test, you take a civil service test, and if you pass the test, you get hired to run the government, and you stay for your entire career if you like. You just run the government. It doesn't matter who's in the White House.
Okay.
And that's the system that exists today.
Yeah.
And, of course, the stalwarts fought this viciously because the spoils system was what had put power in their hands and money in their pockets, and they didn't want anybody killing the goose that laid their golden eggs.
Absolutely.
So that's what's happening in the convention in Chicago. So you've got stalwarts on one side fighting against the half-breeds on the other, and after James Garfield stands up and delivers this very eloquent speech, he was a great speaker, it was said. He gave this speech nominating his friend John Sherman, but it was so powerful to the people, 15,000 people in this convention hall in Chicago, in the heat of the summer. It takes them, after 35 ballots, they can't decide on a candidate. So on the 36th ballot, the compromise is reached. James Garfield, the half-breed Republican, is going to be the president, the presidential candidate.
For their party.
And the vice presidential candidate is going to be a guy named Chester A. Arthur, who was a stalwart and was kind of a dirtbag.
So why did they put the two of them together?
So that they could make sure that when they got on the ticket in November against the Democrat,
they had both sides.
They had both sides.
They had
because they had to. They couldn't afford to lose any of their voters up north.
Right.
They were going
to
lose.
They had to put a stalwart in, and then the half breed, and
that's
there.
Right.
There you go. Yeah. I got it. That makes sense.
And okay. They won in November in a very, very, very close election.
Oh wow, it was close.
It was okay. Very close.
All right.
Because all the
Who
southern states. I wish you hadn't asked me that. Winfield Scott Hancock.
I know you knew.
Was the name of
Winfield.
The man. He had also been a soldier. He'd been a general for the Union Army during the Civil War, but he ran as a Democrat. And the South voted solidly for the Democrat at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the North voted for the Republican. And there's more people in New York than in Mobile. So the Republicans won.
Right.
To horribly oversimplify what happened.
Yeah, I get it.
So Arthur, he's not a very good dude.
This is the stalwart.
This is the stalwart vice presidential candidate.
The dirtbag, you said.
He's kind of, he was known for not dipping his toe into the cesspool of corruption and graft in Washington, D.C. He swam in it.
Okay. He wanted to be in it. Loved it.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably had made him a rich man. Did it?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Much like the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963, which we have covered on this podcast.
Yes.
There was a lone nut who plays a role in this story.
And it was kind of like the same way, too, with the Lincoln's assassination.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, he had some help, but he was the lone nut.
Yeah. Yeah, all four presidential assassinations involve lone nuts. Despite what you've seen on whatever.
I don't know.
Started.
I know. We could debate the Kennedy thing, but I'm not.
It was Oswald.
I'm not sold too much on that after the hospital staff, Parkland.
Ah.
Yeah. I'm not sold.
How many times have we said on this podcast that eyewitness testimony is famously unreliable?
They were not eyewitnesses to the crime.
But they were eyewitnesses to the autopsy.
And that's
they were eyewitnesses
examiner.
To the body.
That's what I mean.
The person that was dead laying on the slab.
All right, we're down a rabbit hole.
I know, we are.
Go back and listen to that episode.
We could go down even more, but that's okay.
So the lone nut in this story, his name was Charles Julius Guiteau.
What a name.
G-U-I-T-E-A-U. Guiteau.
Oh, is he from Louisiana?
His father was French.
Oh.
He was born in Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Charles Guiteau was.
No one from Louisiana, though, in this story.
Not as far as I know. No Alabama connection either.
I mean, kind of like.
Except for us.
You know, the French, Cajun French.
Oh, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
And based on everything that I've read, Charles Guiteau was one of those sniveling little people that we have all experienced at some point in our lives. the guy you try to get away from as quickly as possible.
Try to get away from him?
Because you're just—he's just got that weird vibe.
He's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not going to talk too much, or
well, he might.
Is he going to say weird things?
Yes.
He's just a weirdo.
He was just a weirdo.
Your local weirdo.
He's going to talk too much. Yes. He's going to say weird things. Yes. He's going to do
gonna
both
make
of those
you
things.
Uncomfortable.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
He's that guy.
Yeah. All right.
By the time of the summer of 1880, Charles Guiteau was a failed evangelist.
Oh.
He was a crooked lawyer. And I'm doing air quotes around the word lawyer because in 1880, Katie, you might want to jot this down. You did not have to attend law school to become a lawyer. If you passed the bar,
you could be a lawyer.
You're a lawyer.
I feel like we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
And based on what Candace Millard wrote in her book, Guiteau's examiner for the bar asked him three questions. He got two of them right. And ipso facto, you're a lawyer.
If only.
And Guiteau spent all of his time as a lawyer hiring himself out to collect debts that were owed to other people. But then he would always keep the money himself and claim that that was his fee.
Well, that's not a lawyer at all.
No, it's a thief.
Yeah, I was about to say, you can do some collection work, but that's not really how that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was 1880. You could get away with a lot more stuff back then. Mm-hmm. Guiteau even spent some time in a utopian religious sect called the Oneida Community.
Okay.
And it was a free love commune.
Fun.
But the ladies there had a nickname for Charles Guiteau.
Oh, no.
It was Charles Get Out.
I like it.
Even the... Like,
so you see what I mean about weird.
The what kind of community was this again? Like a free love community?
It was a nudist colony? No, it was a Christian community that taught you the Bible. It was called Biblical Communism is what it was called. It was a collective. Everybody worked together.
Okay.
Everybody lived off the land. You shared everything. Mm-hmm. But this particular person who opened this community, there were 300 or 400 people in it at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But he believed in free love.
So when you
and so
say
did all
that,
the people who lived there.
You when you said free love colony, yeah. I automatically went to like nudist colony right. or like a like.
No, it just meant that you could sleep with everybody or anybody who would sleep with you.
Okay.
It's very
after Bible study.
After Bible study.
Okay.
Or maybe before. Or maybe during. I don't know.
Oh my.
I did not dig down that rabbit hole too far.
Yeah. But they no one
but
wanted
I should have
to,
known you would ask me a question.
No
like
one
that.
Wanted to free love with Guiteau.
Get out was his nickname. And here's what a crappy lawyer Guiteau was. After they kicked him out of the free love commune,
mm-hmm.
he tried to sue them for back wages. He tried to sue them for $9,000 for back wages. He said that that's how much labor he did in the 5 years that he lived there, and they owed him that money, either because he was a lousy lawyer or because the case was deemed frivolous. He lost that lawsuit.
I can't. What kind of labor was he doing?
Just
there?
What everybody did. You know, you worked in the garden or you washed the dishes or you helped cook. Everybody worked together in this commune.
Mm-hmm.
But he was trying to find a way to get money out of it mm-hmm. after they kicked him out.
Yeah.
So he sued them for back wages. Didn't work. Guiteau was also a con man. Maybe no surprise there.
Oh.
He was the guy who never paid his hotel bill. Back then it was easy to... You just told the guy at the desk, hey, I'm having somebody wire me some money. It'll be here tomorrow. And then you duck him for 2 or 3 days. Anyway, he just went from hotel to boarding house to hotel to boarding house, never paid his bill. Mm-hmm. He was that guy. You didn't have to leave a credit card then.
Did he skip out on his check at restaurants?
I'm sure that he did.
Wow.
He had probably been thrown off nearly as many trains as he had ever gotten on because he never bought a ticket and he just tried to hide from the ticket taker until he reached his destination. Evil, petty, narcissistic, grandiose. That was Charles Guiteau. And unfortunately for the Garfield family and the nation, Guiteau had become extremely interested in politics by the time of the 1880 Republican Convention.
Is he a Republican?
Yes. He is a stalwart Republican.
All right.
Staunch. Stalwart. Suddenly, he decides he's going to get into politics, and he picks that side.
All right.
He just kind of got on the bandwagon. That's like suddenly you meet somebody today, they're a Braves fan. Yesterday they weren't. Today they are. Or whoever.
Sure.
He's on the bandwagon.
Okay.
Because he sees money in it.
Mm-hmm.
Among other things. And so in between the summer of 1880 and the election in November of 1880, Guiteau writes, remember he's a failed speaker. He's an evangelist. So he's got some idea about how to put a speech together and stand in front of people and not be too nervous and deliver the speech. So he writes this brief speech in support of the stalwart ticket in November for the election. And he delivers it a few times. But it's one of those speeches where, according to Candace Millard, other people in the room at some point are starting to give each other the side eye and go, what the fuck is this guy talking about?
We don't want
it's
him
that kind of
speaking
speech.
On behalf of us. The other stalwarts are going, make this stop.
Make it stop.
Yeah.
Later, Guiteau's own father would maintain that he had known for years that Charles Guiteau was insane, but the family never had the money to have him committed to an asylum. Mm-hmm. His own brother later said that Charles Guiteau was, quote, capable of any folly, any stupidity, any rascality.
Okay.
The only excuse I can render for him is that he is absolutely insane, unquote.
His family knows this.
Yes.
There's just nothing for them to do.
That's right. But according to Charles Guiteau, his speech was the key cog in the wheel that helped roll Garfield over the top in November of 1880. Garfield owed him for his commitment to the campaign and the party and the election.
But Garfield is a half-breed, not a stalwart.
Doesn't matter. In Gito's scrambled
mind,
brain.
In his mind, that is the reality.
He helped him get elected, and he wants what he's owed.
Okay.
That's where his brain goes.
Goodness.
And because of the legacy of patronage that existed with the spoil system at the time, Guiteau thought that even though there were two warring factions to the party, the spoil system was still going to be rolling down the tracks, and there was nothing that even Garfield, the half-breed, could do to stop it, at least not immediately. He's going to have to abide by the spoil system when he gets inaugurated in March of 1881, mm-hmm. and Guiteau wants what he's owed. And so sure enough, when Garfield took office, and back then the president was sworn in on March the 4th, it wasn't until the 30s that they moved it to January the 20th.
Okay.
So Garfield was sworn in on March the 4th, 1881. He had to deal with literally, I'm not making this up, 100 people every day lined up outside the White House in a line all the way down to the street, waiting for their turn to come in and pitch why they deserved one of the government jobs that had just come open.
Exhausting.
100 people every day. He did it from 10 o'clock until 1 o'clock. For months, Garfield.
Good gracious.
And he only had two secretaries to help him, two private secretaries.
And so who's running things? The people that were in before they get kicked out?
Well, Garfield has a private secretary whose last name is Brown. He's a young man. There's a great story about him that is part of Candace Millard's book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mention him too much today, not at all. But he was a trusted advisor to Garfield, had been for 8 or 10 years, even when he was a teenager. Just another one of those sharp, smart people recognize other smart people. Mm-hmm. And Garfield saw something in this Brown fellow.
Okay.
And so he was the private secretary that was outside the door. He controlled access to the president on a daily basis.
I'm just talking about he's interviewing all of these people.
Right.
To run things.
Yeah.
Who is it? The previous people are still running things?
Well, when I say run things, I mean the job that Charles Guiteau wanted. He wanted to be the U.S. ambassador to either France or Austria.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess there are some government workers, like, you know, there's a cooking staff at the White House.
Sure.
There's a livery staff or whatever you call them. You know, the butlers and the
yeah,
servers.
Sure.
And maybe that was the same back then. So there were other people in the White House that saw to the day-to-day operations, but the Garfield administration had to begin this process
of paying
off the people who had helped them out.
From what we know of Guiteau, any smart person is not going to want him doing anything like that.
And he has told as much.
I'm sure.
Frequently and persistently is told.
By Garfield or by his people?
By the Secretary of State.
That this is not going to happen.
Yes. Between March and mid-May of 1881, Guiteau had repeatedly tried to get that audience with the president.
Is it Guiteau or Guiteau?
Guiteau.
It is Guiteau.
Did I say it wrong?
Well, I was thinking I said it wrong, but no. Go ahead. Okay.
Guiteau.
Guiteau.
But Guiteau showed up so many times, so often, that he ends up back on the shit nuts crazy list at the White House. Mm-hmm. The same look that people gave him when he was giving his speech, they're giving him now when he shows up at the door of the White House.
He's not allowed in.
No.
Gone. Secret Service.
Did not exist.
Did not exist. So who's telling him he can't come in? Who's at the door?
The secretary. Well, the secretary, the private secretary, whose last name is Brown, that is Garfield's personal secretary.
Oh, he's like
secretary
too?
Well, I mean, he's what passed for security back then because there was no security in the White House.
Wow.
Back then.
That seems so strange.
None. So we know that Guiteau did not get appointed to the ambassadorship of either Austria or France.
And we've already had a president assassinated.
That's right. Lincoln.
Not that long ago.
16 years before, 1865.
And we don't have security. I know we talked about this, the Lincoln.
Yeah, we're going to get into that a little bit. So the fact that Guiteau did not get his appointment the way he wanted, obviously, is going to ultimately have deadly consequences.
One more time, what appointment did he get?
Nothing.
Okay, all right.
He got an appointment with a shoe up his ass. See ya.
He got invited not to come back.
Exactly. He's invited to stay outside on the lawn. So, speaking of the deadly consequences, on July the 2nd, 1881, at the Baltimore and Potomac Railway Station in downtown Washington, D.C., we come to the consequences of what stalwart Republican and unbalanced individual Charles Guiteau was willing to do for not getting his appointment from President Garfield. Guiteau shot Garfield at point-blank range in broad daylight in front of dozens of people, the 20th president of the United States.
He had only been in office for a year or three not months. Even a year. Three months. Wait a minute.
Well, 4 months, from March to July.
July, okay.
Yes, July the 2nd, 1881.
They were, it's January now, but it was March back then.
That's correct.
They were inaugurated.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
It was 37 when they changed it from March to January.
Wow.
Right in the middle of 3 months. FDRs. Yeah. Well, they did it back then because it took a long time to travel.
No, I was just talking about he was only in office three months and... And now he's gone.
And speaking, we were talking about this earlier. I hear you guys taking in a breath to ask me, how could Guiteau get so close to Garfield? How could he shoot him from 3 feet away?
There was no security.
There was no Secret Service. It was just, that was the way it was.
Even 16 years after Lincoln had been assassinated, mm-hmm. and that was another true crime we've covered on this podcast, there was no security detail for the president. Lincoln's death was still widely believed to just be a product of the Civil War.
Okay.
Because the president is freely elected by the people. The people still didn't see any reason why the presidency itself was in danger. Mm-hmm. It was just that somebody didn't like Lincoln because he was on the opposite side of the war from them. And we're talking about John Wilkes Booth, of course.
And Garfield is so well liked.
Yeah.
At this point.
Except by Charles Guiteau. So on the day that President Garfield walked into the Baltimore and Potomac. Why did I say Potomac?
It's
the Potomac. You know what? Let's just call it the railway station. By the time he walked into the railway station, the only person standing by his side was his Secretary of State, James Blaine. And that was because they had been discussing something in the carriage ride on the way over to the train station from the White House.
In the carriage ride.
Yes.
Wow. This is another thing mm-hmm. that will give you the time.
Yeah. The president was headed to the train station. He was going to take the 9:30 that morning up to Massachusetts. He was going to be a speaker at his alma mater, Williams College, and then he was going to take a 2-week vacation.
All right.
So he was traveling alone. Among the other men at the railway station that morning to see him off was his Secretary of War, Robert Todd Lincoln.
How about that?
The son of Abraham Lincoln, the eldest son of Abraham Lincoln. Stick a pin in that.
Okay.
Now, as we have already mentioned, Guiteau had been in Washington for almost 4 months by the morning of July the 2nd.
Just stiffing hotels left and right on bills. And
he even showed up. He showed up every day at the White House until mid-May, clamoring for his government job. Skipped from boarding house to boarding house, mm-hmm. leaving a trail of unpaid bills along the way.
Mm. Burning bridges.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he even attended a public reception at the White House in which he walked up to President Garfield's wife, Lucretia, the First Lady of the United States. He introduced himself to her, presented his business card, and carefully pronounced his name to her so that she would never forget it.
That's eerie. Do you know anything about her and her family?
Yes.
Are you gonna
read Candace Millard's book?
Okay.
We're leaving her out.
Wow.
Well, not completely out.
Okay.
You get nervous when I do all the history stuff, so I left it out.
No, that's not what you're doing. You didn't see the woman is important.
The woman is very important.
Okay. That's later. All I needed you to say.
Yeah, later. So by the middle of May the 18th exactly, two things have happened that have changed the life of Charles Guiteau. First, by that point, he had been told flatly by James Blaine, stop coming to the White House. There is no job for you. Your speech did not get Garfield elected, because that's what Guiteau thinks. He thinks, my speech single-handedly got your man elected. I want my job. I want my plush government job.
It's just delusional.
Yes. Oh, and the other thing was that Guiteau had received a revelation from God that it was his patriotic duty to assassinate the president for the sake of the stalwart side of the Republican Party and the very destiny of the Republic.
He did not receive any of that. He is butthurt.
No, sure.
He didn't get his job. He did not receive any. He didn't believe that. That was crap.
In Guiteau's deranged mind, the voice in his head was a divine inspiration.
I roll.
It was at that point.
Yeah.
It was at that point that Guiteau stopped going to the White House and started sneaking around the streets of Washington, D.C., looking for the perfect time and place to kill James Garfield. Took him 6 weeks to get up the nerve from May to July. He at one point even asked for a tour of the district jail in Washington, D.C. because he wanted to find out what sort of accommodations he could expect after committing the act. At least until new vice president, Chester Arthur, would grant him a full pardon.
Of course, because he's also
service he had done to the nation.
In Guiteau's mind, he's like me. He's a stalwart.
That's right.
And he's going to pardon me, and it's going to work out.
Guiteau thinks he's going to get out of jail free. He thinks he's going to be a nationwide hero.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks everybody's going to love him for the service he's provided to the country.
Yeah. Goodness.
So the time period in between Guiteau's revelation in mid-May and the first weekend of July, because July the 2nd was on a Saturday, that period of time, the most exciting of his life for this socially awkward, mentally deranged, little sniveling man.
Is he little? Is he a little man?
Yeah, a little short guy. 5'7", I think. He was going to kill the president. He was going to be famous. And it wasn't, in his mind, an act of violence or cruelty. It was simply practical. Had to be done. In a letter that Guiteau wrote to the American people a few days before he shot Garfield, he explained that he preferred not to shoot Garfield in front of his wife, Lucretia, if it could be avoided. On the other hand, Guiteau wrote in the letter, her husband's death should not be any more painful to her simply because it was an assassination. Here's what he wrote. It will be no worse for Mrs. Garfield to be part with her husband this way than by a natural death. He is liable to go at any time anyway.
He's just rationalizing.
Life is a fleeting dream, and it matters little when one goes. I assume the president was a Christian, and he will be happier in paradise than here.
So he's rationalizing. He's made some sort of connection with the wife, and he's feeling a little guilty about it. I think.
That sounds
there's
right.
Some sort of connection, so he's got to justify, well, she'll be okay.
Yeah. He'd die one day, we all do.
Right, yeah, that's what he said.
So she's not going to be any more upset. Mm-hmm. He's worried about upsetting her.
Yeah, that's right.
That's strange that he made
An insane person.
Connection there, yeah.
So finally, on the morning of Saturday, July the 2nd, 1881, when President Garfield and his Secretary of State entered the train station lobby, standing in the shadows was Charles Guiteau. The perpetual outsider who was constantly trying to become an insider. In his twisted mind, he was about to experience the biggest, most successful moment of his life.
Goodness.
Guiteau was wearing his very best natty suit jacket. He had purposely arrived at the station several minutes before he knew Garfield would arrive because he wanted to get his shoes polished.
He wanted to look good for the day.
He was holding in his hand a .44 caliber British Bulldog pistol, it was called. He had purchased it a few weeks earlier at a local shop, presented with the choice of a wooden-handled pistol or a pearl-handled pistol. Guiteau, the thief, swindler, and miser that he was, talked the clerk into selling him the pearl-handled pistol for the price of the wooden-handled pistol. And the reason that he wanted the pearl handle was because he thought it would look better in a museum after he committed the crime.
Yes, of course.
That pistol was donated to the Smithsonian Institute, but it has since been lost.
What?
Maybe it's in my couch. I don't know. Inside joke. All right. You guys ready for the bad part?
Yeah. Might as well be.
Garfield had only walked a few steps into the station, and he was 3 feet away from Guiteau, like we said, when Guiteau pulled the trigger twice. The first bullet sliced through Garfield's arm, passed through his jacket, and ricocheted off a toolbox that a construction worker was carrying through the lobby of the train station.
Goodness.
Garfield cried out, "My God, what's this?"
Well, sure.
And then the second bullet.
I think I would have said a lot more.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, me too.
He's such a good man. Like, that's what he said. "My God, what's this?"
would have been like, WTF.
A lot more.
Just then, the second bullet came out of Guiteau's revolver and ripped into the president's back.
Oh.
His legs buckled beneath him, and he crashed heavily onto the carpeted floor of the train station. As Candace Millard described the scene in her book, there was a moment of stunned silence.
Yeah.
And then the station erupted in screams.
Mm-hmm. Was he dead when he hit the floor?
Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, that's the crazy part. Well, one of them.
Okay.
You don't know this story?
No. I don't. I've told you. I don't know this story.
Well, you really are a dummy today.
Oh.
Like I was last week. So at first, Guiteau, he tries to twist and turn away as people are grabbing him. But then he realized that they're trying to do more than grab him. They're trying to drag him outside and hang him from a light pole.
They're going
to
kill him.
Yeah. So he shouts to the first police officer that he sees, please take me to jail. Because remember, he's already toured the jail. He's already got his favorite cell picked out.
Good Lord.
And he actually tells the policeman in the wagon on the way to the jail, hey, listen, if you'll let me pick the cell that I like the best, when all of this gets sorted out and the president pardons me, I'll make you chief of police.
Shut up, you tiny little troll. Just shut up.
Yeah.
This is what people want to say to him. Shut up.
Oh, yeah.
Did he let him pick a cell?
I don't know. But the police chief or the police officer, he was a stalwart Republican, so maybe so.
I wouldn't think so.
I don't know.
Just because they're stalwarts doesn't necessarily mean they all want Garfield dead. I mean, they voted for him to be their candidate.
Yeah, but everybody knew that one of Garfield's intentions once he got into office was to demolish the spoil system and end it for good.
I get that, but that's not going to... The policeman's pocket's not
I know, but
altered.
That's where all this tension has come from. That's where Guiteau is going.
Yeah.
There are a lot of editorials in newspapers at the time that say, oh, if you're a stalwart Republican, we can't believe you voted for Garfield because he's really going to do this. He needs to be out of office. Mm. At his trial later, Guiteau waves some of these newspapers in the courtroom and says, they told me to do this. God and the newspapers told me to do this.
Let me ask you this. Did he have his own counsel or did he represent himself?
I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Part.
That's
going
to be.
Getting
I'm
into that
going
part.
To say, I don't believe that a police officer is going to be told by someone they arrested where they're going to put.
Well, Guiteau is deranged, as we know.
Yeah.
He's shaken off this lifetime of poverty and misery and obscurity. And as Candace Millard wrote in her book, he's about to step into the national spotlight.
Yeah, in his mind, yes.
And
he's done a favor to all. Yes.
Meanwhile, back at the train station, President Garfield lay on the carpet in agony, and he would know nothing but agony for the next 80 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Until he died of his injuries on September the 19th, 1881.
80 days.
80 days.
They worked to try to save him and...
If Charles Guiteau was off his rocker, crackers, insane, shit nuts crazy, he got one thing right. When he spoke these words at his own defense a few months later, Guiteau rightly said that it was not he who had killed the president. It was the president's own doctors. For once in his pathetic life, Charles Guiteau was absolutely right.
Oh, no.
And we will tell you that maddening story.
Oh, no.
Right after these words from our sponsors.
Hey guys, I want to tell you about one of our newest sponsors, and that is Cherokee Family Healthcare. Cherokee Family Healthcare is located right here on Main Street in Center, Alabama.
Connie Geimer, who is a nurse practitioner there, is an acute emergency and family specialist, along with Piper Pierce, who's a family and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. They offer many services at Cherokee Family Healthcare, such as
they have primary care, mental health, urgent care, and get DOT physicals. They handle weight loss, IV hydration. We all need that from time to time. You can get a same-day appointment, and walk-ins are welcome.
Yeah, so give them a call
at 256-266-1021.
Hey, guys. Do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best view around at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a day's long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Guys, we want to let you know that don't forget that Easy Street is now open for lunch 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday, open at 11.
Great lunch menu.
Mm, let's do lunch.
Brand new. We've shared it on our Facebook page, and I know that Shane has also shared it on the Easy Street Facebook page, so it's easy to find the menu, and it's terrific. Everything on it.
Yes. What's your favorite thing, Scott?
I like the hamburger steak with the mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes are better than I can make, and I make pretty darn good mashed potatoes.
No, they are.
They're terrific.
Mm-hmm. Katie, what's your favorite?
Yeah.
I like, you can get a flatbread pizza. Mm-hmm. I also like just the chicken fingers.
Yeah, chicken fingers are great. Best chicken fingers in town. How about you, Kelly?
I like the rice bowl with the chicken and the vegetables.
It's all
the
good.
Yum yum sauce.
Ooh.
So delicious. You're not going to go wrong. Salad bar's always fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Have lunch at Easy Street. You might see us there one day.
Yeah, you never know. 11 to 2 every day is when the menu prices on the lunch menu are.
That sounds right.
That's right. Something like that. Everything that comes out of that swinging door is delicious at Easy Street, we promise.
Yes. Thank you to Easy Street for being our primary sponsor, our main sponsor.
Yeah. Thanks, Shane. Go eat lunch.
Yes.
Yes.
Come see us. Thank you to all of our wonderful sponsors. We appreciate you so much. Okay, Scott, please tell us what happened.
Okay, so we're back on the floor at the train station. In the minutes after the two shots were fired by Charles Guiteau into the body of President James Garfield. Garfield was conscious after he was shot, but mostly non-responsive. He was pale, according to one of the janitors who was the first person to rush over to him after he was shot. Garfield couldn't speak, but the janitor said he had this really intense look in his eyes, like, what happened?
Yeah. Confusion.
Yeah. So the crowd has gathered around him to try and offer him assistance. Robert Todd Lincoln is pushing people away. One of Garfield's young adult sons is there with him. They're trying to back the people up to let people get in. Somebody tried to give Garfield some water to drink, but he vomited right back up. Mm. A station agent reached down and loosened his tie and his collar to help him to breathe while they were holding his head up. And now it's time to bring in the clowns. And by the clowns, I mean Garfield's doctors.
Oh, no.
Because within minutes of the shooting, at least 9 medical doctors had magically appeared inside the railway station. And every one of them was eager to examine the president's back wound with his own bare fingers.
Oh, Lord.
One of the men who watched those doctors poke and prod into James Garfield's back, like we said, was Robert Todd Lincoln. He is now 38 years old, and he is standing over his second assassinated president.
Mm-hmm.
First was his father in 1865. He had stood at the foot of the bed at the Peterson House across the street from Ford's Theater, where Kelly has visited.
Yep. Got lots of pictures.
Still on my bucket list. Mm-hmm. So he watched his father die that night in 1865, and now here he stands over his boss, the man who chose him to be Secretary of War. And he's watching his second president die.
Yep.
And we're not finished with Robert Todd Lincoln yet, so leave that pen where it is.
All right.
Before we begin the story of how President Garfield's wounds were treated by his crack team of doctors, we need to talk about an Englishman named Lister for just a minute. You guys have heard of Listerine, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That antiseptic mouthwash is named after Dr. Joseph Lister. It's the germs. It kills the germs that cause bad breath. That's the ad slogan for Listerine,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So by the late 1870s in England, thanks in large part to the research performed by Dr. Lister, he had pioneered this research. Doctors over there had realized that in order to give a patient with an open wound the best chance possible for the body to try and heal itself, was to keep the wound clean, sterile, and free of germs.
Yes.
Antisepsis is what it's called. That's the practice of using antiseptics to eliminate germs that cause disease.
A good practice.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in the USA,
everybody's fingers are in the president.
Thought that germs were not even a thing.
No. Really?
Imaginary. Live in the sky.
You're joking. What did they think infection was?
magic. Not Stop germs. It. They thought Dr. Lister was tilting at windmills.
Hey, those fingers that you just wiped your ass with, stick them in the president, please.
Lister had tried for years with very little success to come across the Atlantic and tell doctors in America about the existence of the tiny little organisms that lived in the air. They were the same ones that caused wine to ferment, he had figured out.
Ah.
But you have to remember, I mean, the doctors in America thought this whole notion was completely absurd.
That's insane.
This was before the best medical minds in the world had even figured out that malaria was carried by mosquitoes. That wasn't until 1897. Penicillin is still 50 years away from being discovered in 1928.
Mm.
And it was not uncommon for surgeons in the United States at the time to walk into an operating room straight off the street without changing their clothes or sterilizing their instruments or even washing their hands or covering their mouths. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they held their instruments in their mouth while they were fiddling with something else.
No.
Yes. And now you are beginning to understand why James Garfield lived for 80 days. Managed to live.
I can't imagine how he lived 80 days.
Well, his gunshot wound was not a mortal wound.
Okay.
It was infection, first of his wound, and eventually his entire body.
Oh, sure, yeah.
That killed the 20th president of the United States. Garfield's doctors at least knew that the bullet had lodged somewhere in his abdomen. But they understood so little about what they were dealing with that they got this part right. They assumed it would be better to just leave the bullet in there.
Okay.
If it hadn't been for them fucking with the wound, Garfield might have been up and around in a few weeks. If they had just sewn it shut and let his body heal itself, he might have been fine. Because there were thousands of people at that time walking around in this country with the bullets lodged in their body because they had come from, they were Civil War veterans. Yeah. They'd come from Shiloh and Gettysburg and Chickamauga. Mm-hmm. They were all walking around with lead balls in their bodies, if they were walking at all, to no long-term ill effect.
Yeah.
And Garfield might have done the same if they had just left him alone. Mm. The problem was that all of those Civil War veterans got at just a very minimum amount of medical care because nobody gave a shit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just sew it up and send him home. Well, turns that worked.
That worked better than you trying anything.
When every doctor in Washington, D.C. wants to get his name in the paper because he wants to be reported as one of the doctors treating the president.
Mm-hmm. Ugh.
Poke pride. Garfield died from an overabundance of medical care.
And their germs.
Garfield's doctors did become obsessed with trying to figure out exactly where the bullet was in his body. I mean, that was the reason for the poking and the prodding. They were trying to figure out exactly where the bullet was. But the bullet had ricocheted off of a rib and changed direction. It had ricocheted off of his spine, not in a way that would have paralyzed him, but it ricocheted again. It lodged behind his pancreas. It hadn't done any major damage. It hadn't hit an artery. If they had just left him alone, it would have been fine. Probably.
Meanwhile, the little troll is still in jail jabbering away.
Yes. But so in this attempt to... Yeah, we're coming back to him.
Okay.
But in this attempt to find out where the bullet was, they called Alexander Graham Bell. Remember, he just invented the telephone 5 years before. And he had since invented a very rudimentary version of a metal detector. It was the world's first metal detector.
Okay.
But when they used it on Garfield, they couldn't find the bullet, and there were two reasons why. Number one was that they didn't find this out until later. The bed springs underneath Garfield were metal.
Shut up.
Yeah. Didn't think of that. And the other reason was that Garfield's medical team didn't want to get shown up by this scientist. So they only let him use the metal detector in a small area of the president's abdomen where they thought the bullet was. But I just told you, the bullet ricocheted twice in his body and it ended up on the other side of his body from where the doctors thought that it was. And they didn't figure that out until the autopsy. They found the bullet finally. And one of the doctors said, well, it was us who killed him because we'd never looked there. If they'd found it, they might have gotten it out, sewn him up, he might have been okay.
I don't know, with all the infection and
There's a lot more, there's a lot more about what Alexander Graham Bell did to try and help the president. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole story about Alexander Graham Bell, because the reason that Candace Millard ended up writing this book about the Garfield assassination, she was researching for a book about Alexander Graham Bell.
Okay.
And she stumbled across this story where their lives crossed paths. Mm-hmm. And she realized that she had a bigger, better book that told both stories. Yeah. So there's a lot more about Bell, because Bell has some, he has some family tragedies that take place. He loses a baby in childbirth just about the time all this is happening. Mm-hmm. So he's traveling back and forth from DC to Philadelphia or Boston, wherever his office was, having all these things go on in his life as well. Mm-hmm. She writes this story kind of, you guys have read Devil in the White City, right? Eric Larson's book about H.H. Holmes.
Yeah.
And the Chicago World's Fair of 1893.
Yeah.
It kind of tells both of those stories. It alternates chapters. Mm-hmm. Millard did the same thing. A lot of the same stuff in this book about.
And then finally joins the two.
Yeah. Right. So after 2 months of lying dead still in his, no pun intended, dead still in his bed on the second floor of the White House. And just to be clear, the reason he wasn't in a hospital is because you only went to a hospital in the 1880s if you had nowhere else to go. Hospitals were filthy. They stunk. Were much better off at home or inside your doctor's house in a bed.
Doctors came to you, yeah.
That's why doctors came to you. It was cleaner at your house than where all the people gathered together, even though they didn't know what germs were yet. They knew it was bad for everybody to be at the same place.
Diseased people, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Garfield, who had maintained consciousness throughout this 80-day ordeal, even though he lost down from 210 pounds to 130.
Wow.
Because what happened was the doctors, more stupidity from the doctors, they thought that the more he ate, the more likely he was to get better. So they're shoving food down his throat, and he's constantly vomiting it right back up. So Garfield had had enough of the poking and the prodding, and he'd also had enough of the isolation, because his doctors kept him in a room on the second floor of the White House. At least it was air-conditioned. It was the first air conditioner that was ever installed in a house in the United States. The Department of the Navy figured out a way to cool air with ice, blocks of ice and fans, and they kept the room cool. But it made a lot of racket, and he hated the noise. But it was the first ever air conditioner. At least in this country. But in addition to that, he was isolated. The doctors wouldn't let anybody else in the room. They kept sheets or screens all mm-hmm. around all four sides of the bed. They kept him isolated. And he said, screw this. I'm tired of it. And the reason the doctors are doing this, it is speculated, is that because the doctors knew that Garfield was actually in much worse condition than they were telling the newspapers mm-hmm. yeah. that he was in. Because no doctor wanted to be the one who killed the president. They all wanted to be the one who saved him.
They're just hoping that he's just going to make a recovery.
He's hoping he's going to make a miraculous recovery. And so ultimately, when Garfield died, it was a shock to most Americans because they'd been reading that he was getting better every day in the papers mm-hmm. from the mouths of his doctors. Bigger and stronger every day is what they were saying. Mm. In fact, by the middle of August, Garfield was getting much worse. Mm-hmm. Well, a little bit worse every day. His symptoms regularly included fever, the chills, restlessness, vomiting, pounding heart, profuse sweating, all symptoms of septicemia.
From an infection, from germs.
Because the doctors had poisoned the president's bloodstream with all of their
germs.
Dirty fingers. In other words, Garfield, he was rotting to death from the inside. Garfield's body was so toxic that at one point, one of the doctors treating him accidentally cut his finger on a scalpel that had been used to clean up the president's wound, I guess. Mm-hmm. 2 days later, that doctor's hand was so swollen and painful that he had to walk around with it in a sling until his body fought off the infection.
I thought you were going to say he lost his hand.
No. But just getting a little bit of the president's poisoned blood in his blood, boom. So you can imagine what Garfield's body, especially, he's lost, 80 pounds?
Can you imagine the pain this man is in?
Constant pain.
I can't imagine.
And I told you guys that Garfield couldn't keep food down, right?
Right.
At one point, Garfield's doctors tried feeding him rectally.
Oh.
For 8 days, every 4 hours. They fed him with a tube placed exactly where you think it was.
What's in the tube?
I looked it up. There was beef bouillon.
Oh, my Lord.
An egg.
No!
And theoretically, the body could soak in the nutrients in this soup.
They are literally shoving food up his ass.
That's correct.
Like food, yes. Like eggs and beef. No. Yeah.
Oh, and a little bit of opium. A little drop of opium.
Well, finally, that makes sense.
Anyway, that didn't work. That they tried it for 8 days. All the time telling the nation as a whole, via the newspapers, the president is getting better every day. He should be up and around in no time. And then they go upstairs and say, Mr. President, will you please turn around and bend over?
Good Lord.
Now, by near the end, Garfield realized that he wasn't going to make it. Smarter than his doctors. If there were 20 doctors in that room, Garfield was still the smartest man in the room. We've gone over that.
It's a lot of people smarter than these people.
So Garfield finally says, look, docs, I'm through with this.
Yeah.
I want you to take me to my seaside home in New Jersey. I want to see the ocean one last time before I die.
And take that tube and put it up your own ass.
Yeah. Or put it somewhere else and blow on it. On September the 6th of 1881, he was transported by train from Washington, D.C. to New Jersey, where he died September the 19th, with Lucretia by his side. Still in his prison cell in Washington, D.C., when he received word of Garfield's death, Charles Guiteau was beginning to wonder where his beneficiaries were. He had handed the presidency to Chester Arthur, right? When he shot the president. Mm. Where was the love of a grateful nation? For the man who had sacrificed so much to save the party and the country. This is what Guiteau thought.
Right. Well, sure. Yeah.
Actually, the nation was pretty much all on the let's hang the fucker side of the
Don't
let
him
ledger.
Out of jail because
And they
that's
didn't care if he was
dangerous.
Insane or not.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It turned out that he was in jail for his own protection.
Yeah.
And even that wasn't enough. At one point, one of the soldiers guarding him outside took a pot shot at him with his rifle through the window of his jail cell and missed.
Good gracious.
A newspaper editorial the day after that happened criticized the U.S. military for its badly trained marksman.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Guiteau was having the time of his life in prison. He was interviewed repeatedly by reporters from newspapers all over the country. And the whole time he's trying to figure out how to make money off of his newfound fame.
Good gracious.
Or infamy, if you prefer. He wanted $25 for every photograph that was taken of him. He handed each reporter who interviewed him a list of his preferred questions and demanded that they all mention his soon-to-be-published autobiography, which he was working on while he was in prison, as well as his upcoming candidacy for president in 1884.
Oh, God.
Despite Guiteau's probable psychotic condition, notice I said probable.
Probable, yeah.
He was indicted for the death of Garfield in October of 1881, 2 months after the death.
No. To his shock.
Yeah. To his shock, certainly. Yeah. The trial began on November the 14th. During his trial, Guiteau declared that he was not responsible for Garfield's death, admitting to the shooting but not the killing. Garfield wrote, Guiteau wrote that General Garfield died from malpractice.
I mean, that's true, but they wouldn't have had the opportunity had you not shot him.
That is correct. If we had decided to stretch this story further than just one episode, this would be where we would drill down a little bit deeper because the trial was nuts. Mm-hmm. It was the most prominent case in the history of American jurisprudence in which the insanity defense had been attempted. Now, just briefly, we'll hit some highlights. The trial, first of all, was a national sensation. It was the trial of the century in 1881, a long time before O.J. came along. People fought every day to get into the courtroom, and those lucky enough to get a seat often took a picnic lunch with them so they didn't have to get up at the lunch break and risk losing their seat.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as we've already said, Guiteau claimed that God told him to kill the president. At one point, he stood up and shouted to whoever wanted to listen, I admit to the shooting, but not the killing. He had a lot of these outbursts in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
whether for show or not, we don't know. Guiteau's lawyer was his brother-in-law, the only man in the country who was willing to defend him. And he said that he only did it because he knew good and well that his brother-in-law was crazy.
Yeah.
An unstable fanatic.
Yeah. So he was trying to do the right thing in his mind, I guess. Yeah.
So this legal team, like I said, they're arguing the insanity. God made me do it. I didn't kill him. The doctors did. They are on the very frontier of legal precedent. After this chaotic trial, in which Guiteau interrupted, argued a lot of times with his own brother-in-law, his defense or his assistant co-counsel, the jury reached a verdict on January the 25th, 1882. Guiteau had spent a week on the witness stand. The trial took 72 days. The jury took an hour.
Checks out.
When the jury foreman read aloud the verdict, the crowd in the courtroom burst into thunderous applause. Guiteau was found guilty. No surprise.
No.
He was sentenced to death by hanging, and that sentence was carried out on June the 30th, 1882.
When was he sentenced?
January of 1882.
Okay. So, yeah.
So if you ever find yourself, for whatever reason, in Cleveland, Ohio, I can't imagine why, but let's just say that you're in Cleveland, Kelly.
All right.
You can visit the James A. Garfield Memorial at Lakeview Cemetery.
All right.
His tomb is a round stone tower. It is 50 feet in diameter and 180 feet tall. It's decorated with stained glass. It has interior balconies and stairways inside, and there's a 12-foot tall marble statue of President Garfield. Today, he and his wife are both buried there.
Oh.
Lucretia passed away 37 years later.
Oh.
In March of 1918, she was 85 she passed away.
Wow.
And so as we wrap up today's episode, there are just a couple more things to mention by way of a conclusion. For one thing, the death of President Garfield did bring the country back together in a way that had not existed for decades, even before the Civil War. And even after the Civil War, the South and the North still hated each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was slavery, and that was, but it was when Garfield died, it brought the nation together. They had one common he was everybody's president again,
mm-hmm.
and the people of the country had someone to mourn over together. And by the way, Garfield wasn't even 50 years old when he was shot. He was 2 months shy of his 50th birthday when he died.
Goodness.
For another thing that happened after Garfield died, stalwart piece of crap Chester Arthur, the new president, he did a complete 180.
Mm-hmm.
Once he was sworn into office, instead of continuing to take advantage of the spoils system that had elevated him as high as he'd ever gotten in the Republican Party to begin with, Arthur decided that it was his duty to continue the policies of the man who he replaced.
Aww. How about that?
And so 2 years later, in 1883, the government, Arthur signed into law the Pendleton Act, which reformed the civil service, established the Civil Service Board, did away with the spoils system, no more political patronage, you get your job based on merit, and that system is still in place today.
Awesome. Way to do the right thing.
Yeah. You guys remember that I mentioned that Billy the Kid was on the run in 1880 during the convention?
Yeah.
Okay, so Garfield gets shot on July the 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
On July the 14th, Sheriff Pat Garrett caught up with Billy the Kid and shot him dead.
Well, there you go. Okay.
That was in mid-July of 1881. Regarding the protection of future presidents, there would still be no Secret Service in the aftermath of Garfield's death. Aww. It would not be until McKinley was shot in September of 1901, while he was at the World's Fair in Buffalo, New York, that finally somebody said, you know what, we're going to have to start protecting these guys.
Three go down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. And that's another story for some other time. One last thing, the very last thing before we go. You guys want to take a guess at who was standing beside William McKinley when he was shot in Buffalo, New York in 1901?
Was it
Lincoln?
Robert Todd Lincoln.
Are you kidding me?
Three presidential assassinations, Lincoln found himself on the front row of history three times.
Uh-uh.
Lincoln himself recognized these ridiculous coincidences. He is also said to have refused a later presidential invitation with the comment, "No, I am not going. And they had better not ask me again, because there is a certain fatality about presidential functions when I am present."
Yeah.
And that is the end of our episode about the assassination of President James A. Garfield.
What a story, Scott.
That really is crazier than I thought it was.
Yay!
That was a great job.
I couldn't believe it. I didn't know any of that.
And if you enjoyed this episode, say something nice about us on our Facebook page, Instagram. You can go to Spotify and leave a comment, Apple iTunes and leave a comment. Email us, truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com. Is that it?
That sounds like enough. Is that it? Are we done?
We're done.
Good night, everybody.